Arctic Entries, a storytelling program based out of Anchorage, visited Talkeetna on November 16th of 2016. The event was put on by the Talkeetna Historical Society and hosted at the Sheldon Community Arts Hangar. Seven local storytellers shared tales on the theme of "It Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time." The tape begins with Talkeetna Historical Society Executive Director Sue Dio.
I'm going to introduce Colby from Arctic Entries, and she's going to tell you a little bit about Arctic Entries and the program tonight, and we'll get started. So take a seat, come on in, and enjoy the show.
Hi, Talkeetna. Thank you, Sue. My name is Colby, and I am a story coach for Arctic Entries in Anchorage. We are very excited to be in Talkeetna again for the third time this year, and third time total, I believe. I'm new to Arctic Entries. I've been coaching for the group for the last few months. We're in our eighth season, and it's great to be in Talkeetna. This is only my second time here ever, and it's my first time here in the winter, so I feel like it's really my first time experiencing it like a real Alaskan. My nose has been permanently cold and red for the last 24 hours, so thank you for that. Really making me feel like Anchorage is not the true Alaskan experience. So a little about Arctic Entries. We have three main rules. The rules for our stories are that storytellers must tell a story that is about 7 minutes long. That's the goal. We will give a storyteller a warning at 5 minutes, and we have a magic noise maker for that, Eva. So they'll hear that at the 5 minute mark, and then again, a little bit more enthusiastically at the 7 minute mark. And there's no punishment besides public shame and embarrassment if they go over 7 minutes, but kind of keeps things all about the same. Keep it friendly, small town, you know. The next rule is that the stories must all be true. We want to hear accurate, real things that have happened. And the third rule is that these stories must be about the storytellers themselves, things that have actually happened and featured the storytellers. That's it. Other than that, they can be about any and everything. And we have a really, really awesome interesting range of subjects tonight. So it's going to be a lot of fun hearing some stories from folks that you know and I am just getting to know. Another part of Arctic Entries is that we always have a local musician, singer, and or songwriter to play a few songs throughout the show. So I'm very excited to introduce Chris Grabowski. He is a local musician, and he's going to start us off with a song, and then we will head right into the stories. Thank you so much for being here, and thanks for having us in Talkeetna.
I'm going to do three original songs tonight, and they're pretty much stories. This first one was inspired by a gal here in town a few years ago who told us she was having a hard time with basically adult men saying she didn't have a valuable opinion because she was a woman. So I decided to write a song to those fellas, and it's for her and other women and girls that are someday going to be women with valid opinions. It's called Let Her Fly. Let her talk, let her think. I want to hear what she has to say. She's got a mind of her own. Let her roll her own stone. It's time you let go of your old ways. When she stands, listen up. Times have changed, enough's enough. Let her live her life her own way. Time to stop being so afraid. It's time you let go of your old ways. You could learn so much if you would just open up. Everyone deserves the chance to fly high. Unbridled energy, she's going for all of her dreams. Don't try to shut her down. Lend a hand and lift her up now. It's time you let go of your ways. Little girls, speak your minds. You'll be women in a short time. World can be a better place when we live our lives with grace. It's time you let go of your ways. It's time you let go of your ways. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. So our stories tonight range from one end of the United States to the other, really, truly, literally, from the East Coast all the way out to the Aleutian Islands, and from 40 years ago all the way to 4 days ago, and literally, truly. The first storyteller is probably really well known in certain parts of the state as the voice of McGrath. In other parts of the state, he's known as a trail sweep for the Iditarod. Locally, a lot of people know him as the general manager of KTNA. But years and years ago, he will take you back to a time when he was none of those, in a small little town in Alaska. Everybody, Will Peterson.
Thank you, Sue. I should tell you before I start my story, Sue is my board chairperson, and she told me if I didn't do this, she'd fire me. She also told me there'd only be about 6 or 12 people in the building, so. This story is called, I've got two names for it, actually one name and then a kind of a subtitle. We're coming up to Thanksgiving, and I'm sure everybody has their own Thanksgiving traditions. So the name of this story is Thanksgiving Traditions, and the subtitle is What's Wrong with Guns in the School? I came to Alaska in 1976 to be the first high school teacher in Anvik, a community of about 100 Athabascans over on the Yukon River, about 300 miles west of here. I think if you talk to those students today, they'd say I learned a lot more than they ever did. And I did. I had just come straight from New York to Anvik, and I learned a lot. And I started school, we started school in August, and one of the first things I learned about was the Athabascans and how they celebrate Columbus Day, which was kind of strange. But we're coming to Thanksgiving, and it was my first Thanksgiving away from family, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do for dinner. And I wasn't sure what the community did for dinner either. And on the Monday of Thanksgiving week, I asked the students, what are the traditions in your culture, in the Athabascan culture? And because about 100 people, there were about 5 or 6 of us white guys. And they said they eat turkey like everybody else does. And I thought, well, probably before frozen turkeys were delivered to this town, you did something different. So they went home, I asked them to go home, and they asked the parents and grandparents, what did they do before frozen turkeys were delivered to Anvik? And they came in the next day and they said, they used to do a rabbit feast, the whole community. So I was real interested in that, and I said, well, how do we do that? And they got a couple of the dads involved, and they do a rabbit drive. It didn't take too long, and I decided, let's do this. Well, we didn't have much time. So a rabbit drive, here's what we did. We all hopped on, again, this is 1976. Those of you who have snow machines can picture the snow machines back in those days. John Deere's, there were some Sears snow machines. Seriously, there were. I don't know if you've ever seen them. But we all hopped on snow machines, 2 or 3 people on a machine, and we crossed the Yukon River right there. The river is probably about half a mile, 3/4 mile wide. And we went to this island called Long Island on the east side of the river. Those of you who have been on, who know rivers, the upriver side of an island usually has a cut bank, and then the downriver side usually is a sloping grade to the water level. Well, we had, I should back up just a little bit here. I had 11 high school students in that school that year. And the rabbit drive tradition was the men are the hunters and the women will prepare the meal. Well, this is a public school, and I guess I was a little progressive, and I said, well, the girls have to come on our rabbit drive. And since we only had, I think there were three girls in that class. And then there were some more seventh and eighth graders, and I said, and I told the adults in town that we had to bring in the seventh and eighth graders too. We needed more people. So we had about probably 15 or 18 seventh through 11th graders. There weren't any seniors. And probably about 10 adults. We thought we were adults anyway. And so we hopped off. I didn't say this, we all had guns. Everybody, seventh graders, and 22s and shotguns. It wasn't, you know, no AR-15s. So we crossed the river, get to the top of the island, dropped off three or four of the men on the river right below the cut bank, and then we all went down. The island was about a mile long, about quarter of a mile wide, maybe a little wider, and we started driving the island. And we're walking up the island, and we're, you know, maybe 50 feet, 75 feet between us. Again, we're all carrying rifles. And the idea was we're gonna drive rabbits through the island, and the guys at the other end are gonna shoot them. Well, we kept walking, and I'm not seeing any rabbits. I'm the new guy in town. I'm the stranger in a very strange land. And I occasionally you'd see a rabbit track, but we're not seeing any rabbits, and everybody's talking, and we're just walking away up, and we're getting closer to the end of what I thought would be the island. And we pretty soon you start to see a rabbit here and a rabbit there, and everybody's kind of staying on the same line moving forward. And as you're getting pretty soon through the willows, this is mostly willow islands, and you can see through the willows that you're getting to the end because you can see the clearing, you can see the river up above it. And as we got probably, I'm not sure, maybe 100 feet from the top of the island, the cut bank, there were rabbits everywhere. And there were guns going off everywhere. And I was 25 years old, I'm the teacher, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what are we doing? So a bunch of the rabbits went off the cut bank, and the guys down there were shooting them out of the air, and there was no alcohol involved, I should tell you. And we slaughtered the rabbits. I mean, there was blood all over the place. There were dead rabbits. I don't really recall, but it was probably, I'm sure, close to 50 rabbits that we brought home for the elder women to skin and cook for us. And then on Thanksgiving, we had a full community feast with rabbits. And I think of that Thanksgiving tradition every Thanksgiving. That's my story.
Thanks so much, Will. Our next storyteller, this one goes back a ways too, but this woman has lived in Talkeetna, well, most of her life. And like a lot of women, she has a story to tell. It's just sort of, you know, thinking that she could be somebody she wasn't by getting something to make her look like Madonna. It just sort of, anyway, you'll hear from Robin Rivers about how it all happened and what went wrong.
I'm not supposed to use notes, and I'll try not to because I'm really nervous. This was in the 80s, and I was invited to a lingerie party right here in Talkeetna, believe it or not. Woo! Now, the theme of this talk tonight is supposed to be, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So, thank you. Anyway, it seemed like a good idea at the time. I don't remember exactly who the hostess was, but, you know, I was getting ready to go to college, and on my shopping list were under things. So I'll go to the lingerie party and see what there is. For those of you that don't know what a lingerie party is, it's a home party where they either have the items there to show you, or there's a catalog and you look at it, and the hostess takes a commission off of anything you might order or buy. Well, I got there, and there wasn't anything practical. There were no long underwear. There were no jog bras. It was just like fancy bras and sexy lacy nighties. Well, being the practical Norwegian that I wasn't too impressed, but I did find one thing in the catalog that caught my attention. It was a Wonder Bra that provided instant glamour, and it took off 20 pounds. Now, that caught my attention. I was all over that. So I let the hostess take my measurements, and I handed over my $60, and she promised to mail the prized magic garment to my Colorado college address. And away I went. Well, a month later, I was in Colorado, and the package arrived, and I was so excited. I took the package up to my apartment and went to try on this bra. Whew. Man, was it uncomfortable. It was horrible. It was painful to put on. It was a 1950s bullet bra. And with my cup size, it was actually a torpedo bra. So this bra with its impressive scaffolding is, the advertisement said it was made to lift, mold, correct, and hold. You know what a bullet bra looks like. It's increasingly smaller and smaller concentric starched rings that culminate in a point. Stop laughing, Donnie. When I put this on, I look like a pair of missiles poised for launch. It was really embarrassing, and besides being horribly uncomfortable, so I thought I'd, you know, fix it a little bit. So the first thing I was going to do was wash it, and I ignored the washing instructions that said to put it on delicate and cool water, and I just threw it in the washer on normal and washed it. And I tried it on again, and it didn't help at all. What am I going to do? Okay, I'll put it in hot water, and I'll wash it again. I tried it on again. It was no good. All right. I'll put it in with some jeans and dry it with some tennis shoes and beat it. Tried it on again. It didn't work. I was starting to get really ticked, you know. I spent $60 and I still hadn't lost those 20 pounds. What am I going to do? I mean, should I take like the meat mallet and pound it? Oh, that's not going to work. And then in the kitchen, I saw my cast iron bean pot. So I took the bean pot and filled it with water, and put the bra in there, took the soup ladle, stuffed the bra down, you know, worked it in the bean pot. There were no beans in there. Put it on the oven or on the stovetop and set the burner to low simmer, because I knew from experience that this was going to take a while with this bra. And then, you know, I go for a hike. I went for a hike, and I was gone about an hour. And as I start to come back to the apartment, I heard sirens. around the corner where I could see there was black smoke billowing out of my second-story apartment window. A little closer, there was all of Glenwood Springs Fire Department out there with the trucks and all of the apartment tenants all out there like you guys. And I ran up to the fire department and identified myself as the resident of that unit. And then, just then, the fire chief came out of my upstairs apartment deck, out of the sliding glass doors. You know, he was up there. We were all looking. And he had on the end of the soup ladle, which was obviously my bra, but it was black and smoldering. And he was a tall, handsome, sort of a Sam Elliott kind of guy. And he was really embarrassed. And he came up to the deck, and he looked at me, since I was the person in there, and he goes, "Ma'am? Ma'am?" Pushed his hat back. You know, how is he going to say this? Because it's politically correct in front of all these people. "Ma'am," he stuttered, and then this look came across his face, and it's like, "Ma'am, I think you burned your tennis shoes." Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. And I'm not even sure what to say about that. Our next storyteller, this is another teaching story. She has taught in Bahrain, and when she got back, she ended up on the East Coast and in a place that a lot of us probably can't even imagine what it would be like. But her story is what it was like to be in that situation and learn a little bit from those students. Chrissy Sloan. Chrissy is the Talkeetna Elementary literacy teacher. And Chrissy.
Before I was here, I taught in Newark, New Jersey, and I taught in the inner city. I taught fifth graders. I taught them literacy and science. And I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. And I was just dumb enough to do it. So I remember, and the other thing was is that about 90% of the kids that I taught were African American. I was one of the only white teachers in the school. And I remember we had training. When I first was there, there was a teacher who taught next to me, and his name was Mr. Jones, and he told me, he said, "You know, if you ever have any trouble in your classroom, like I'm right next door to you, so just, you know, just give a shout, like I can help." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, whatever, you know." And little did I know that I would be screaming, "Go get Mr. Jones!" about, I would say, easily 5 to 10 times a week. It was actually a class job for somebody to go get Mr. Jones when I screamed, "Go get Mr. Jones." But there was often trouble in my class. And what happened was there were a lot of fights in my classroom. And the kids that I had in the afternoon, I had them for 2.5 hours. And I would always say that I could keep it under control for the first hour. And then the last hour and a half was a complete show. And so one day I gave the kids an assignment that they had to go home and ask their parents about their name. And they were going to come back and report to us what they learned. So the kids did it, and this one girl got up, and her name was Akiah, and she said, I was named after my great-great-grandpa. And, you know, we were like, "Oh, yeah, that's great." You know, we all clapped, and she sat down, and then it got to hour two. And I was helping a student with something, and one girl, Shai Davis, she was passing out papers, and she came up to Zakiya, and I was behind Zakiya, and I just heard somebody say, "Your mother." And if that happened in my classroom, that immediately spelled trouble, like if somebody said "your mother." So I heard somebody say your mother, and then I heard somebody go, oh, yeah? Well, your great-great-grandpa's dead. And Zakiah screamed a scream that I have never heard since. And she said, I'm going to kill you. And she got up out of her seat, and I turned around and quick enough to grab her by her coat, and I was screaming, go get Mr. Jones! And I was screaming. The kids, you know, they were laughing. I mean, they were all excited. There was going to be a fight. And she was screaming that she wanted to kill Shaydavia. And Shaydavia was, you know, trying to stay away from her. But Mr. Jones heard the screaming. And he came in and he said, what's going on in here? And Zakiah was, she said my great-great-grandpa was dead. And he said, well, shit, girl, your great-great-grandpa is dead. Let's go. And he hauled her out. And 10 minutes later, she came back in after she was calm. And I said, well, Zakiah, why did that make you so mad? Like, she just said he was dead. And she was like, you don't mess with my dead folks, Miss Sloan. You don't say that. And I was like, okay, I gotcha. And then this was in December. We were having a good day. We hadn't had a fight in a while, and I was in the back doing something. I never knew what I was doing. But I looked up, and Shaydavia and Zakiah were at the front of the room, and I just heard, "Oh yeah!" And I screamed, "Go get Mr. Jones!" And by the time he got in there, they were going at it. And I was trying to hold Zakiah off, and she was screaming again, you said my great-great-grandpa's dead. I'm going to kill you. And he said, oh, no, girl. Is this about your great-great-grandpa again? Let's go. Let's go. And he hauled her out. And so that was the first thing I thought that was a good idea in the class. But it was later in the year, and I'll preface this story with the fact that Mr. Jones was not at school this day. And it was a bad day. We had, all I can say is the class was in utter chaos. There were fights erupting. I had an aide in the classroom with me, but I couldn't control it. He couldn't control it. And I was just sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? Like, I don't know what to do. And so I yelled at her. I said, sit down! I have something to tell you. And they all kind of looked at me like, well, okay, you know. And I was like, I've never told you this, but I have the ability to tell the future. I can tell your fortunes. I was like, it was passed down to me by my great-great-grandmother. And, you know, I have this ability. I said, but the only way it's going to work is if you're really quiet. And they were intrigued, and so I said, you know, whoever wants to hear your fortunes, like, come on up. And so they were lining up to come up to get their fortunes read. And by that time, the aide and I were looking at each other, and he was like, oh, yeah, she can. I know. I've seen it. She can do this. We were in it together. And I was telling the kids their fortunes, and I told one girl that she was going to be a travel writer, and I was like, your favorite place is going to be Ireland. And I was like, and it will be your favorite place because you're going to meet your husband there, and his name is Kevin O'Shea. And all the kids were laughing. They were like, we don't know no Kevins. What are you talking about? Like, and then I told another kid, he really wanted to be a football player, and I said, you know, I'm really sorry, Coffrey, but I don't see playing football in your future. But I do see that you're going to be a commentator for the football games. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's awesome, you know. I told another girl that she was going to be a math professor. And she was like, but I hate math. I'm not good at math. And I said, Cheyenne, this comes to me. I have no control over this. You know, this is what I see. And so almost all the kids had come up to get their fortune read. And but there was this one girl, Khadija, who never came up to get her fortune read. And then after class, she came up to me and she said, Miss Sloan, she was like, I know that you can't read fortunes. I know that that's not real. And I said, oh, Khadijah, yes, I can. You know, it's a skill. And she said, no, I know that you can't. And she stared at me. And she said, I know that you can't because you didn't say any of us were going to be crack addicts. And you didn't say any of us were going to have babies at 15. And you didn't say any of us were going to get shot dead in the street. And when she said that, I felt shame. I was so sad that I had done that. And I felt shame because I felt like I had done something self-serving. I just wanted the kids to be quiet. I just wanted them to not fight. And, you know, she saw it for what it was. And she called me out on it. And I thought, you know, I'm this white girl who comes here and I have no idea what your lives are like. And I'm giving you, you know, telling you these things that's not your reality. And I felt horrible. And I never did it again. The kids always asked me, like the kids in the other classes would ask me to read fortunes, and I was like, oh, well, it comes and it goes, and now it went. And so I never did it again, but I think of this story now, particularly now, I think it's very noteworthy because, you know, what's happening now in our world, I think about that, and I think about Khadijah, and I think about how I would love it if, you know, Khadijah lived in a world where the fortunes that I told were completely possible for her and that she believed them. Thank you.
I just want to tell people, and she might get mad at me, but it took Chrissy over a year to be able to tell that story again and feel good about what she has done. So she sort of deserves an extra applause for being able to have the guts to stand up. So, well, on at least semi-lighter note, we're going to go to another person who's been here for a long time, and his story goes all the way back 40 years as well, into the 70s, a story about when he was first beginning his trade out in a faraway land as well. Larry Rivers, everybody.
Well, this goes back to 1976. I had just spent 3 years as an assistant guide out at the tip of the Alaska Peninsula in the Aleutian Islands, which is about 800 miles west of here. It was my very first year of guiding on my own, and I had two clients from Texas who were good friends and wanted to hunt together. So they had explained that they really loved adventure. They liked being out in places that were a lot different than Texas, and they were really looking forward to this. Well, I describe adventure as being insecurity. If you know what you're going to do and how it's going to turn out, there isn't any adventure to it. But if you don't know what you're going to do and don't know if you're going to live or die, there's a lot of adventure. And we were in for a truckload of adventure. Fortunately, they were really good guys and put up with it. So a little background on the Alaska Peninsula, Cold Bay area, is there's lots of wind. Some of the people in here have been out there and know that there's really a lot of wind. 20 knots is considered light and variable when they talk to you on the radio. Runway of your choice. 40 knots is common. 60 is common. 100, 110 is not uncommon at all. When the wind blows on the airplane, when you got it tied down, if it's blowing on the prop, it'll sit and turn the engine through, keep RPM up. When you get up and walk, you'll be leaning into the wind, and if the wind cuts a little bit, you fall on your face. And you get up and you dig. It takes forever to go upwind, and unfortunately, you're always hunting that direction into the wind. You tear little holes in your hat so you can peek out through it, and it drives the raindrops in. And it ruins your binoculars. You clean your binoculars, and you turn around, and you go, bury them, clean them again. And in Cold Bay, they have cables over the buildings to keep them from blowing over. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So you start to get the idea. Ravens that fly to the dump on windy days are known to walk to the dump. And when you get up in the morning, if you want to see how hard it's blowing, you look in the toilet, and if there's little white caps popping in there, you know it's a pretty severe day. And that's for real. The wind is blowing over the vents on the houses, and it causes toilets to go pop, 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 which is a good day to stay indoors. So that's where we are on the weather. So I can't even see it in all this stuff. We'll forget that. So this was the first hunt, and I was determined to make a good impression. And there was a beautiful weather we had then. It was gorgeous, sunny, beautiful sunsets, and somehow I lost my mind and forgot about all this wind. And there was a camp I wanted to go into where I figured we could get two bears. The guys were also hunting caribou. I figured we'd get a little caribou meat. We could get out there in a hurry. And I took two big, comfortable Eureka Ranger tents that look a lot like sails, and we flew out there and landed at the very top of this valley. I also took two logs that I had tied to the belly of the airplane. Fortunately, it wasn't completely nuts. And we buried those and used them for tie downs. Well, we sat and enjoyed the winds, the sunset that evening, and cooked a meal, and the wind started to pick up. And as we finished up supper, it turned into a gale. And by the time we were crawling in bed, it was a full-blown southwester coming through there. And the plane was shaking in the ropes, and our guys climbed into these tents that now decided they were sails. And they're trying to sleep in it as the wind pounds down on these tents, folds up all the rods, lays the tents over my clients. The wind is blowing the rain in sideways. They're soaked on one side. The rain's driving through the tents. These tents had nice, cute little rain covers on the top. Never planning for them to be in the wind, and I don't know what I had been thinking of. But they were soaked on one side and dry on the other. Well, these winds came in like this, and they blew for days. And they would crawl out of these wet, sopping tents, and we would go hunting. And at night, they would crawl back into them, into those sleeping bags, and somehow they kept their spirits up. But it kept blowing, and we were running out of food. And in walking down the valley one day, into the wind, we looked down, and there was an old, old cabin down on the beach. Well, we got a slight break, and we had to do something to get out of these things. So when we got a little break in the wind, I jumped in the airplane. I flew down to the beach about 2 miles away. We landed. We pulled the airplane back up into the sand dunes, and we went into this old trapper's cabin. It was made out of timbers that were about 4 inches thick, 12 inches tall, stuff they made docks out of. The guy had really built it, but it had rotted away. The big hole in the roof, hinges had rotted off, the door fell off. But we went in there and went to work because it was shelter. And we found some shovels, and the handles had rotted away, but we started shoveling out through a hole in the wall, and I came across an old pair of big cannery boots. And I just pulled them out, and as I pulled them out, there were still leg bones in them. Which was something as a surprise. And as we dug in, the fellow that had been living there was still in there. And all he could, what do? You pick him up and you say hello and send him out the window. We needed the cabin more than he did at the time. And we cut his clothes into strips and used them for caulking in between the wood to keep the wind from blowing through. And I took my knife and cut the soles off of those boots. And we put the door back up. There were some old nails in there and a hammerhead that we used by hand. And we hammered those soles of those boots into the sill, into the side of the timbers and into the door to make hinges. And I have pictures here tonight of what it looks like 40 years later. I went back there and I have pictures of it with the soles still on those boots, on those doors. So anyway, we moved in there, and we are out of food. We had expected to be eating caribou, but the caribou were all up in the alders laying low. The only thing was moving were bears. And in those winds, if the bears didn't move in that country down there, they would starve to death. So they move all the time. So we were about 7 or 8 days into it, just living off what little cabbage and stuff we had left, when we saw a bear go down the beach. And we took off in all that wind and followed the bear down. Out around a rock point he went. We lost him on the other side. And as we were turning around and coming back, around this point, wading in the water now, we hit the other side, and I heard rocks falling. And I looked up, and this bear was coming down that rock slide. We had pushed him up and over the top. And he looked at us, and I looked at him, and that bear turned on us and charged. And we had seen a couple big bears, and I told the clients, don't shoot, it's too small. And all I heard was, I have to, boom. And that bear, fortunately he killed it, it rolled right up, hit us in the legs. We fell over the top of it. And it went rolling down into the ocean where we skinned it. By now we are soaking wet. And the hide must weigh 200 pounds soaking all that water. And we drug it in the ocean, waist deep, in that storm, back to that cabin. But we had bear meat to eat. And I've never been much on bear meat, or especially brown bear meat, but that was some awfully good brown bear steaks that kept us through for nearly the next week. We did get out of there. It did finally break. But I learned a valuable lesson. It's really helpful to have people with a good spirit and a love of adventure. They became lifelong friends, and they hunted with us many times. And I learned that I don't go across the street in Alaska without a sleeping bag and a rifle. And I don't go anywhere flying without at least 2 to 3 weeks of food. And I've never broken that rule since.
Chris Grabowski has another song for us.
So it was about a year and a half ago, Dennis Ranzi and I were hired to play in a band, and Dennis plays congas. And I realized then that as a drummer, Dennis never has any say in the set list. So I said, Dennis, you really should write a song so that you can say, hey, it's my song, I want to sing it or play it. And he's like, I'm 65 years old. There's no way in heck I could write a song. Never done it in my life. And what would I write about? And I said, oh, I love your railroad stories when you worked on the Alaska Railroad. And he came up with the chorus just like that. And we said, you got a song, dude. Go home and write it. So he did, and I put the music to it, and it's called Percussion and Steel. Came up from Utah in 75. Wanted some adventure in my life. Wanted to live life wild and free. Heard Alaska was the place to be. Well, I'll make some money and I'll find my honey. Much more fun playing my drums, oh yeah. I got a job working for the railroad. That's when I made a whole lot of dough. We put down track in Dunbar and Chase. Hurricane Talkeena, you name the place. Well, now I made some money and I'll find my honey. Much more fun playing my drums, yeah, yeah. Driving railroad steel was a job I liked. When we came through, that track was spiked. 500 miles of percussion steel. Making good track for those big driving wheels. Well, I made some money and I find my honey much more fun playing my drum, yeah, yeah. Stopped off in Healy and we hit Paul's Bar. Sweet Miss Becky caught my eye from afar. We got hitched before too long. She's the girl for whom he wrote this song. Well, I made my money and I found my honey. Much more fun playing these drums, yeah, yeah. Caught the train and got dropped here in town. Thought we'd take some time, take a good look around. Never did leave and we're living here right. Still hear that train screaming through the night. Well, I lost my money, but I got my honey. Much more fun playing these drums, yeah, yeah. Well, I lost my money, but I got my honey. Much more fun playing my drums, yeah, yeah. Well, I lost my money, but I got my honey. Much more fun playing my drum, yeah, yeah. Thank you. It's called Percussion and Steel.
Thank you, Chris. I'm going to move this on anyway. Our next storyteller is, you know, we all have our story of how we got to Alaska. And this person is a full-time writer. He's published books. He's been a broadcaster. He's on the radio and does a lot of things. But Peter Mathiesen will tell a story about how he actually got to Alaska. Peter.
Now, just so everybody knows, I am not the Peter Mathiesen with two T's and two S's. I did not write the Snow Leopard. I would like the royalties, but I did not. So, you know, we all got here somehow, one way or the other. Some of us came, some of us were born here, some of us came here. And like a lot of people, I always wanted to come to Alaska. Come up here for work all the time. Somehow I would scam editors to pay me to come to Alaska and spend a month here. And I managed to do that for almost a decade. And finally, I kind of looked at my wife and went, "Well, don't you want to move there? You know, I mean, it would be awesome. It would be great." And so, you know, we talked about it, and there were other, you know, things going on in our lives that kind of made it seem like an opportunity. And my daughter, Becca, who is here somewhere, our fabulous art teacher here in Talkeetna, she was, yes, here. Thank you. Yes, that's my daughter. That's right. Yeah, she was like, "Yeah, let's go," you know. Well, my wife was a little more cautious, but all in all, she, in the end, she was really game. She only asked for one thing. She asked for a vista. And I thought, "Oh, no problem. You know, that's easy. You know, we can do that. That's no big deal." So, you know, we sell our house, we get our stuff together, and you can imagine it's pretty tenuous. I mean, those things are big life events. And so we finally come up, and now here's the amazing thing. I had been to Alaska dozens of times. My kids had been to Alaska. She had never been here. Not one time. Not one time. Yeah, everybody's going, you know, and it's like, wait till she sees the bugs, man. Oh my gosh! And I was smart. We came up in May before the bugs came out. That was kind of planned. And so, you know, we did this big drive around everywhere to go look at homes. And we started out in Homer. I'll be honest with you, I was very familiar with Talkeetna. I'd been here a lot. But I was just happy to move. I mean, I was wherever she wanted to go. So she gets to pick the house, not me. I was smart enough to not pick the house. She at one point even wanted me, oh, you just go and pick a house and I'll show up. And I went, who knew? Who knew? No. I'm not doing that. So, you know, no worries. So we go to Homer. You know, who doesn't like Homer? You know, and we drive around and, well, you know what? She didn't like Homer for whatever, for, you know, a series of odd reasons, you know. So one thing leads to another and we end up in Willow. You know, and we're getting closer. Hey, it's not the valley. You know, it wasn't Wasilla, you know. And, hey, I'm just scrambling to make something happen, you know. And we end up looking at a house on Willow Creek. And, I mean, this is a nicer, one of the nicer homes we've looked at. And, man, it sits on the river. I mean, it is right on the river. You could sit on your deck and watch salmon swim by. And I'm thinking, I'm home. This is it, you know, and she's like, oh, you know, floods and erosion, and I don't know, and you know, and you see that rock wall, it looks like it's been replaced, and I just don't think so,
Okay.
You know, it's like, so I'm kind of dejected, you know, it's all right. So, you know, we literally go down the road the same day, and we find a log cabin on Cashwitna Lake. You know, it's a long cabin. See, this was before I knew that really old log cabins are probably not a good choice. But it seemed like a good choice, you know. And, I mean, we're looking at the cabin, and it's got an unbelievable view of the mountain. It really does. You know, and she's like, you know, it's on a lake, it's got a view, it's kind of dark, it smells really bad. I'm like, I can fix that, come on, you know, it's no big deal. So, you know, it's like, okay, we won't get that house. So, you know, we come up the road, we find our house in Talkeetna. You know, it's a shell, and 2 years later, well, really, 6 years later, I'm still working on that house. But it has definitely become home, and we have certainly enjoyed our time here, and it was an excellent choice. Well, you know, it was such an excellent choice that on September 12th, 2012, I get a copy of the Anchorage Daily News. And there's a guy with a garbage bag over his shoulders in hip waders with water right up to here, and guess what house he's walking away from? I am not kidding. And I'm looking at it going, huh. And I go, okay. So I show the paper to my wife, totally admit, you know, that this is,
look, yeah, you were right.
You were right. I was wrong. I'm sorry. You know, it's like, yeah, this was a good idea. So, you know, we kind of commiserate and feel sorry for the poor guy who really looks miserable, carrying all of his life possessions in a garbage bag. And so, you know, a few years pass by, and it's the summer of 2015 in July. You know, it was kind of a warm, dry, nasty summer. And it just so happens that the house on Cashwitna Lake was a half a mile south of Sockeye Road. Well, that house is no more. So clearly, I am not the guy to choose a home in the state of Alaska. And my wife, who had never been to Alaska in her whole life, was way smarter about choosing a home than I was. And for that, honey, I thank you. And please wish my wife a happy birthday, which is tomorrow. Love you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. So this next, I'm going to tell a story about this next story. because this storyteller, she's like, oh yeah, I have this great story, and I heard it last year as she was trying to practice it, and she ended up not telling it. Okay, it's good to go. And on Thursday, like 2 days ago, she calls me up and she's like, can I change my story? Okay, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, she has a great story of about 4 days ago. Everybody, Wendy Patino.
Get comfortable.
I just realized why you changed your story.
Oh, the other one would have been easier. So, Mini Wakoni. Water is life. So, we're driving down the road, I've got my iPhone open, and I am pressing buttons and trying to figure out where is that little dirt road we're looking for, we're supposed to turn down, and suddenly the signal goes out, and I don't know where we are, and I look up, we've crested a hill in the plains of South Dakota, and beautiful grasslands everywhere, and we crest this hill, and suddenly, there they are. Lots of military guys dressed up in full combat gear, I guess in riot gear. And I can't see their faces. They have masks over them, and they seem to be very weaponized. And all I can see are their mouths, and they aren't smiling. And there's a tank, and there is a huge semi with a satellite dish going around. And my cousin is driving, and I say, "Turn around! This is the wrong way! Turn around! You turn!" And so she flips Yui in the middle of the road, and we go back. And we look for the right road that we're supposed to be on, because we don't want to go through the police blockade. And we find it, and we find this little dirt road, and we follow the dirt road down, and we see the sign for the Standing Rock Reservation. And it just seemed like such a good idea 3 weeks prior to go to Standing Rock. And as I get there, I realize for a moment, I hate leaving Alaska. I love Alaska so much. I really am not into confrontation. Oh, I'm very claustrophobic. Like, things get dark and I whimper like a small animal. And there's a good chance I'm going to get arrested. And then we drive onto the reservation, and I see the Missouri River laid out in front of us, and thousands upon thousands of tents and people and teepees, and it's beautiful. And then I remember I hate crowds, but it seemed like a good idea, and here I am. And so I take a moment, and I breathe, and I call on Bear, because this is just this thing I do, and I say, "Bear, can you help me out? Give me a little strength." And I calm myself for a moment, and I do get a message. And Bear says, "Just walk the land and get your strength and learn." So we go down into camp, and we set up our little camp spot by the Missouri River with 5,000 other people of the Lakota and Dakota Sioux Nation and their 7 other tribes, and many, many other indigenous and non-indigenous people from around the world who have come to make a stand at Standing Rock to not protest, but to protect the land. That is the whole mission, to be there for the water and the land. And this is in response to the Dakota pipeline that is being built and probably groundbreaking, they hope, in a few weeks, to be built under the river, the Missouri River, which is the only water that these people have. And so they're there to protect it. And why have I come? I've come because I love water, I love land, and I love people. Those are my three things. And besides all that, I've tried to live an authentic life. And when I heard about this issue, I thought, this is authentic. If I'm going to be me, Wendy, authentic, I must go and see what I can do to support. This is our life, right? This is our chance. So for all these reasons, I end up there, and the moon is just coming up, and it's a huge orange moon, and everybody in camp, 5,000 people spread out, stop and face the moon, and we hear this, and I realize it's all of us, it's coming from us, and it's just a quiet, nice howl. It's very wonderful. And immediately after that, there is a huge spotlight on us that comes from across the side, the other side of the river, and it's like 20 feet up, and there's a line down the river for, I don't know, a mile, and there is spotlights on our camp. And it makes it very hard to walk around. It's blinding, and it is the military-industrial complex that is protecting the pipeline over there. And everybody seems used to it, and we wave, and it's daunting. And then soon after, the drones start flying, and they're kind of loud and annoying, and they circle all night long, and helicopters and planes, and this is a no-fly zone. So this is life at Standing Rock, a piece of it. And then we all wake up together and we get to work in the camp. The elders are there teaching, telling stories by the fire, moving things in and out and supplies, and helping the world understand what's happening so that we can protect the water. And that's why I'm there, to do work. So I get asked on one of these days that blur into each other if I will participate in a ceremony, and I'm invited to come to a medicine wheel ceremony. And I say, yes, I will come. And they are hoping for a few hundred people to take a walk out to Turtle Island, a special spot where they want to hold a ceremony for the water and make a stand. And so I go, and I go to learn, and we are talking on the way out, and it takes many hours, and we are literally walking through the plains. And I think, oh, I'm walking the land. I'm supposed to be doing that. And thank you, Bear. And as I'm walking, I'm talking to elders and hearing stories, and there's drumming, and there is sage being burned, and it's very peaceful. And they're teaching us how to not protest, but protect. And so they say, if any police come, we're going to go up to the line where they're holding their line. We're going to wish them well. We're not going to interact, and we're not going to get anything going. We're here to honor the land and build a medicine wheel. A medicine wheel is an ancient ceremony, and it is something that has been happening in indigenous cultures for hundreds and hundreds of years. And you build a big circle, and you have all the four directions honored. And they want to build this with all of the people to teach us, but also to teach the world. And they're going to videotape this as a ceremony and to honor the waters. So there's a section of the circle that is red for people of indigenous color. There's a white section that honors many of us here. There's a black section for the people of color, and there's a yellow section for people of Asian persuade. And it's just honoring all the peoples of the world. And so we create this huge medicine circle. It is probably 100 feet wide. And we sit in the circle, and we put all of our kids in the middle because the wheel moves around them. And then the indigenous people come around the outside of the circle. I'm sitting in the circle with people, and the indigenous people come to the outside because they are there to protect all of us. That is their job, to protect the land and the water and all of us. So it's quite wonderful. And as we're sitting there, I notice on the other side of the river there are police in riot gear, but they're sitting down on the hillside and kind of watching, and we wave and they wave, and it all seems quite calm and lovely. So our ceremony is done, and we get up and we go to move back to camp where you end the ceremony. And there is one gentleman a white boy, who decides this is an opportunity to do more. And he starts jumping around and he tries to get us motivated to follow him. Now, we thought there was 300 or 400 of us, but we learned when we made this giant circle that, in fact, there are almost 1,000 of us there, peacefully making this circle. So it's quite nice. So this white boy starts jumping up and down and saying, we've got enough people here. We could take them. We could run across the river and run up that hill and take them. And I'm thinking, I saw some tanks, and then they have helicopters, and I am not sure about this. And he's starting to get people riled to go that way. And the elders and the indigenous people say, we are not doing that. Our ceremony is to go back. Go ahead and let him do what he's doing. We're moving back. And as he's jumping around the river and looking threatening, the police start coming. And suddenly there's more and more and more of them coming down the hill. And it's looking tense, and they're starting to grab their weapons. And he is getting his clothes off and ready to jump in the river. And there are people milling around. And the word goes out, our ceremony is not here. It is to walk back. And so I start trying to help and tell people, oh, yeah, we're going back. We're walking our ceremony. And this group of 900 to 1,000 people turns slowly and starts walking back to camp. And I turn and look over my shoulder and see the man, and he's pulling his pants back on, and the white man by the river, and seeing that nobody's following him. And so he just puts his clothes back on and walks behind. And the police stop, and they turn around and go back. And we have this beautiful video that has now gone viral about this ceremony. And we went back to camp, and it was all good. And so as we were walking back to camp, I realized, oh, yes, this was a mighty fine idea to come here. Thank you.
And we could probably, whoa.
Holy
okay. We could probably have a storytelling session just with Wendy and her stories. It took her a long time to get that down to the amount of time that it needed to be. So great job, Wendy. You did a good job with that. And our final storyteller tonight, the one that makes every single person laugh, he has a story that you really are going to wonder, how did you become, he's going to tell a story about before he was a pilot, and you're going to say, why, how did he ever get to be a pilot after this? But Don Lee, everybody.
It's nice to see so many people that I know here. I guess exactly good to see Dave and folks, and it's great to be invited to this. I was very fortunate to live out of town when I first came to Talkeetna, and I worked at a lodge, and of course aviation, you soon find out, becomes really the heartbeat of a remote setting. All the food comes in, clients in and out, the airplane becomes very important, and it was really a privilege to get a chance to ride in the airplane, you know, because I was just one of them. But the airplane people were like, you know, they had that total freedom. So anyway, the opportunity came to, after I was out there for about 3 months, to go to Anchorage and get some building materials. So it's like, yeah, of course you jump at the chance to do that. So a German, elderly German guy owned the airplane, but he couldn't speak very good English, and he was very nervous around flying in Lake Hood and Anchorage, very busy place, because his English wasn't very good. And so picking up building materials are heavy. A little box of nails weighs 50 pounds. A roll of tar paper, you know, is like 80 pounds. Glass, small, but very heavy. And I did the math, and I weighed about half of what I weigh now. and unbeknownst to us, a friend had stopped by and also put two cases of wine in the very, very back of the airplane. When you fly aircraft, it's all about the weight. But it was fortunate and unfortunate. The wind was blowing about, it was really windy. And for Anchorage, it was like maybe 30 miles an hour. White caps blowing pretty hard. But we still thought that this, you know, wind is good. Airplanes make wind. They fly in the wind. Everything's wonderful. And there's a few gusts of 40 or so. And I hadn't had my pilot's license yet, but I was, of course, very eager. And I was sitting in the right seat, and, of course, this very typical German who owned the lodge was in the left seat. And so we have everything loaded, of course, way heavier than we really realized we were. And he takes off, roaring into the storm, into the wind, and a gust of wind had caught the aircraft, and we went straight up in the air. It went from seeing the ground to total sky, and fell back straight back on its tail, and I didn't know it at the time, but had of course bent the floats and damaged the aircraft quite heavily. But now, with all the noise, the ELT is going off at this point, which is a very distinct boo, 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 really loud, and you can't turn it off. It just really, and it's constant. It doesn't stop. So he panics and fall back down on the floats and actually gets into the air, which at this point is now becoming quite scary because the airplane doesn't quite want to fly. These Cessnas... Now, I'm hanging, there's a very thin rubber piece you can hang on to, which doesn't give you very much comfort. But the Cessnas have a stall warning system, which when the airplane reaches an angle of attack where it's going to start to stall, it makes a very clean beep. We're stalling, you know, everything's, oh, put the nose down. Well, as the stall progresses, the noise turns into this ragged beep, really loud, horrible, ragged, this thing is doing a yeah, and these big hairy arms on this guy, and he's all nervous. Now his eyes are this big, my eyes are this big too. And in like that amount of wind, not unlike a river, when you turn downwind, you're instead of going over the ground like at 40 or 50 miles an hour, now you're going over the ground at 80 to 100 miles an hour, like in a river current. We started down Spinard Avenue. And I'll never forget, Gwenny's has a mural on the side of their building there. And I'm looking up at it. We come by, and it was just so surreal. It comes like this, whoo, and then disappears. We're flying down Spinard, under wires. I could see people on the street going like this. It was like every second, it was like, brace myself, we're gonna, this is it. Oh, God, we didn't do it. People handle fear a lot of different ways. Fear, one of the definitions of fear is the outcome is in doubt. Well, it was seriously in doubt. So and down under the wires and cars, and then he turns left on Minnesota, and he goes, and down we go, and the airplane, the whole time this noise, pew, 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 of the ELT and the, yeah, and he's fighting the controls, and he trims it, and I'm going, and it had these bubble windows on the pilot side. He looks out, back, and he looks up. At this point, I don't think I could make my eyes any more wider than they already were, because I think this is an emergency. And I, yeah, this is an emergency. The horizontal stabilizer was bent up along the rudder, which it's not supposed to be that way. The elevator works together in the back of an airplane very simply. Well, when it's cocked up at 90 degrees sitting next to the rudder like this, now you only have half of one, and the yoke is jammed, so you can't do anything because instead of going like this like it's supposed to, now it has an 80-degree bend in it. So anyway, we're through. We're coming down Minnesota. I'm not sure if we went over or under the big, because now I was worried about the lights, the big lights now. It wasn't just stop signs. And it was just, it just seemed like an eternity. This is it. I take my stomach. We're going to hit. No, we miss it. And you just go, you know, it's just so surreal. And the noise, boo, 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 boo. Ah, yeah. And so Anchorage is up on a peninsula. It drops down about 100 feet down to Cook Inlet. Well, the wind's so strong. And if you know the inlet, man, it's just going like this. The wind's knocking the top 2 feet off the waves. It's just a white froth. And if you're in the water, you're dead. You know, not right over the top of the waves. Yeah, you just barely touch. Yeah, and it's like he thought, should I land? I said, oh God, no, not in the inlet, because you just that'd be it. You never make it anywhere. The tower had seen us disappear behind the trees over the top of the Millennium, and now they had people. The fire rescue were out. Of course, I found out later were looking for us, looking for a plume of smoke someplace, and so. Now we're looking at the white cliffs across the way. Now we just barely are making it over the inlet, and I'm already more terrified than I've ever been in my life. And I knew we weren't going to be able to gain altitude. We were lucky enough to get 100 feet drop where we could get a couple miles an hour to get over the waves. And so now it's like Point McKenzie, and it's like a 200-foot cliff there. And you go, this is not good. And so here comes the next one. It's like, okay. And there was a little push where the little estuary where there's a little brine water reedy swamp, and fortunately he was able to at that point we weren't going up, we weren't doing anything, and whoosh went into the grass, and basically at that point it was uneventful. But I found out really quickly, you know, the smell of fear is a lot like poop. and so that's pretty much the conclusion. Fear has a lot of different feelings and smells and reactions, but pretty much smells like poop. Thanks.
The title of that one was The Smell of Fear. Yes. Well, that is our storytelling for the night. Chris is going to sing one more song, and then we'll conclude. Chris?
So I wasn't sure what song I was going to do to finish tonight, but I'm going to do what I think is my best song I ever wrote. It's a love song. Haven't seen a sunny day as beautiful as you. Never seen a smile that warms me like you do. Looking into your eyes, the feel of your touch. Wanna spend my life wrapped in your love, because I love you. Yes, I love you, darling, I do. Because I love you. Yes, I love you, darling, it's true. In the dark morning hours, just before the early light, we laugh and we play, share the stories of our lives. I waited so many years for this time, and now you're here. You light up my life, 'cause I love you. Yes, I love you, darling, it's true. Yes, I love you. Yes, I love you, darling, I do. Because I love you. Yes, I love you. Dawn, it's true. And maybe someday, when I ask you, you'll say I do. Thanks.
That is our show. Thank you so much, everyone. Before we break for the night, I just want to give one last round of applause to our seven wonderful storytellers. And to Chris Grabowski for the music. And also to Sue for bringing Arctic Entries to Talkeetna three times this year. Thank you so much.